Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine. I'm Jeet here, a columnist for The Nation. This podcast is also widely available on all platforms, as well as some radio stations. So this week, the monster we want to take up is a familiar one, which we've discussed before, Elon Musk. In particular, the kind of controversies around his use of drugs. Shortly before he left the White House, an article appeared in the New York Times, which detailed, among other personal issues, extensive use of ketamine and other pharmaceuticals. And Donald Trump, although he has surrounded himself in this administration with many substance abusers, is kind of known as someone who doesn't look upon favor, even like something like drinking. His brother was famously an alcoholic. And I don't know if he objects so much to substance abuse so much as if it becomes public or if it becomes kind of known. In any case, this has become something that Trump has apparently raised in private. And I thought it'd be good to like move beyond the sort of personal issue of Musk and to think about it more broadly, like because Musk is certainly not the only one using the substances. And there's a kind of culture of substance use in Silicon Valley. And I was very pleased that my guest today, Jacob Silverman, had posted on this and suggested that he might do his next book on this topic because it's a very rich topic. Now, Jacob Silverman is a very distinguished financial journalist. He has a forthcoming book called Gilded Rage, which will be about Elon Musk and his radicalization, and also is the author of a recent book, Easy Money, about the crypto world. And he's been on the program before, but I'm very happy to have him talk about this. Welcome, Jacob.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So when we're talking about, as I said, like, you know, Musk's use of these substances is not his alone, and there's something broader happening in Silicon Valley. I thought you might have some thoughts on that or some context for that.
Sure. I mean, it's something that comes up a lot, I think, actually, even just in my own work covering tech or talking to people in tech. Of course, at the top of all this kind of it is Burning Man and the Burning Man culture, which Musk has partaken in. But it's just something that increasingly comes up. Like when I covered the fall of FTX and the Sam Bankman-Fried trial, a lot of people at that company were using amphetamines or stimulants. And it was something that actually Sam Bankman-Fried and Caroline Ellison would post about. One of them had a tweet that said something like stimulants in the morning and you know, sleep aids at night or something to that effect. So you see it from different angles in tech. You know, there's the performance and optimization aspect of it, which also exists in finance and elsewhere. There's the sort of escapist or creativity, be some cognitive elite somehow. And there's also sort of classic recreational abuse. But I think there are different sort of motivations and kind of and contexts and ideological tributaries that feed into this. But yeah, it's certainly something that comes up for me or that I hear about or encounter people even, you know, they're into, of course, hallucinogens, ketamine, and uppers when they want them.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's probably worth pulling back and thinking about this on a sort of broader historical context, which I did in a recent column for The Nation. But because I think a lot of people, when they think about, you know, like San Francisco drug culture, will think about sort of, you know, the classic hippies and the counterculture of the 1960s. And that was certainly there. I just recently reviewed a biography of Robert Crumb, and it makes a pretty strong case that the whole sort of underground comic scene received a huge kind of spark from the use of LSD by Crumb and others in the 60s, and sort of psychedelia. So it is I think some people will be taken a bit back to think of, you know, like not these grungy hippies living in Haight-Ashbury, but the sort of corporate leaders of America are doing the same thing. You know, like there's perhaps a longer or broader history of this. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think, especially if you're talking about drugs from a performance-enhancing perspective, or at least what they claim to be. So many of the people who now are among the Silicon Valley rank and file and the elite, you know, grew up increasingly in the age of ADHD diagnoses, or just people recreationally doing, kind of semi-recreationally doing Adderall in college, say, to get through work. So for the last few decades now, it's been commonplace in a way for people, certainly people who pass through universities, to be exposed to drugs as this aid. And then you can go farther back, I suppose, to other industries or other aspects of the tech industry. But what you were talking about also with the 60s and LSD, I mean, early tech people, especially in the Bay Area, or working more in kind of the research context of like Xerox labs, consider themselves part of the counterculture, or at least having been inspired by it. Yeah, maybe they were going a little corporate, but, you know, Steve Jobs talked about taking LSD and being a very formative experience for him, and relayed that to sort of his experience as a CEO. I mean, there's a way in which, because some of these people came out of the counterculture, they're able to metabolize drug use and things that might be seen as even anti-capitalist or anti-work about drug use, and merge those two together, sometimes under this mantle of productivity or being more of a visionary executive.
Yeah, you know, I think that's really true. And I mean, you know, going back to, I mean, like early LSD, you know, in the sort of post-war era, you know, had a big kind of research component. It was part of the sort of, you know, Cold War culture, you know, growing out of Sputnik, that, you know, America will win the Cold War through the science war. And certainly LSD research was something that the CIA infamously was very interested in. And, you know, like as part of that era's concern in the 50s with mind control, the CIA was invested heavily in it, but also research companies. And there were research labs in the early 60s. I was encouraging engineers in the San Francisco era to, you know, what we would now call microdose LSD as a performative enhancement, opening up creativity. And yeah, that whole sort of intersection with hippie culture with Silicon Valley is very important. I mean, in some ways, Silicon Valley saw itself as rebels against the older style organization man, which was, you know, kind of seen as stifling American business. And there were sort of, I guess, cultural junctures. I think one thing I would mention is the Whole Earth Catalog. Which both had a kind of, you know, Buckminster Fuller, Starship Earth, you know, holistic view, had people like Robert Crumb as contributors, but then was also like, you know, sparked a lot of futurist thinking among the sort of engineer set. So this is a kind of like common culture that really goes back, you know, at least to the 50s and 60s. And as I think I mentioned in my piece, in the 50s, there were these kind of like libertarian businessmen who were going, you know, part of Bohemian Grove and would hang out with Herbert Hoover and dream about, you know, rolling back the New Deal while also dropping acid. So this is
fascinating,
like,
combination.
Yeah, it's something that has existed for a long time. So are there any other like ideological currents that we could kind of like bring into thinking about like how these things all sort of go together?
One thing you did mention there was even decades ago, people microdosing. That's another thing we haven't mentioned yet. That's kind of helped more recently bring a lot of this stuff into more respectability. And then I think one stage also that we've passed into is with the legalization, at least of some, mostly just of weed, but a sense that's, some things are headed there, or I guess what I mean to say is you see all this investment now in psychedelic-based medicine and startups, and especially biotech startups based around what we normally think of as recreational drugs being used as medicine. And in some sense, it's very positive for some folks, but it also has activated a weird weird sort of tranche of Silicon Valley where you have the libertarian right that you were talking about from decades ago is now actually very like Peter Thiel, or there's a kind of German analog to him named Christian Angermeyer. There are other people in Silicon Valley who are very invested in companies pursuing MDMA based therapies or other psychedelics. And that's where you do see this strange merger again of a seemingly progressive attitude towards some drugs, but then, you know, being grafted or repurposed in into the Silicon Valley startup structure and the ideology behind that.
Yeah, and I sort of feel like deregulation or the sort of, you know, questioning of the regulatory state is part of that, you know, coming out of libertarianism. And certainly like some stuff that I think like many of our listeners and many progressives and leftists sort of agree with, like, you know, the war on drugs and the sort of criminalization of drugs having a very bad effect. But also, I mean, like with a kind of very libertarian attitude. And it's interesting that, I mean, the New York Times had a very good kind of op-ed with somebody looking at this, making the point that, you know, for a lot of rich people, it's possible that these psychedelics could have a very positive effect. And if they do have a bad trip, they have, like, you know, resources that can help them deal with that. There's a way in which, you know, like with all sorts of free market things, this could have a very different impact on like ordinary people, like in terms of like, you know, if they don't have the sort of, you know, psychedelic safety net.
I mean, there's a story from the Wall Street Journal from a year or two ago when they were reporting on Musk's drug use, where Larry Ellison, the founder of Oracle and a pretty spooky guy in some ways, including his CIA associations. But he said, apparently suggested to Musk, come to the island of Lanai, which he owns something like 98% of, and maybe dry out for a bit and just take it easy. Which one, I think, shows the depth of the problem if someone like Larry Ellison is saying that. But also, of course, yeah, we don't always have that that network of elites sort of cleaning up after us and helping us fix our mistakes. And so, but that's also why, like, these tech elites can market themselves as reasonable drug users who, for them, it's okay, and it's at most it's cognitive enhancing or enhancing of their creative abilities. But they would never, you know, they would never be painted as in such a dark light as like the street fentanyl users that they in San Francisco that they demonize.
Yeah. I mean, it is actually interesting. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned the fentanyl users, because this kind of weird kind of dichotomy, because I mean, not uncommon in libertarianism, where it's on the one hand sort of like, you know, deregulation for the elite, and then many of these same people like are, you know, stoking a moral panic about crime, and also more importantly, you know, legitimate panic in the sense that, you know, like, I think, you know, homelessness and crime are serious social problems, but more importantly, like, you know, like putting forward, you know, like a return to the sort of carceral solutions and, you know, return to like a sort of, you know, like war on crime solution. So that seems to be a bit of a dichotomy, like, you know, like drugs for me, prison for you.
Yeah, I mean, tech libertarians are rarely consistent or even very libertarian in practice, but I think there was some interest even among the broader Republicans during Trump's first term about criminal justice reform, and there's people who can speak to that being a more bipartisan cause at one point. But now, you know, their authoritarian side is just so strong, and that even the ones who sort of claim that they're Democrats, or like Alex Karp, the head of Palantir, who's claimed to support Kamala Harris, is as militant and authoritarian seemingly as they get. And some of them are, you know, like Chris Larson, who's a founder of Ripple, and he's supposedly a Democrat and has supported Democrats, but he funds a private surveillance camera network in San Francisco that the police get access to. So exactly what you said there, they sort of see every luxury and for themselves and like, you know, they can get away with anything, but, it's a much different attitude when it comes to the lower classes, and they've really contented themselves with responding with carceral solutions and violence, and sometimes investing in those solutions.
Yeah. I mean, if one thinks about it, like in economic terms, they're invested on both levels, right? Like both, like, you know, some element of legalization, and certainly deregulation and trying to weaken the FDA is something that, you know, Peter Thiel is heavily invested in. But then also like dealing with any social cost through increased incarceration, which they can also profit from.
Right. I think there's the profit side is very important, and it sort of and their comfort with sort of authoritarian power, but also I think one thing that we're sort of getting at too is that they're very impatient. You know, this actually in a way relates to accelerationism. Like they're really eager to get somewhere, to get to the promised techno-utopia or techno-fascist state that they want, that in some ways they feel really impatient about, and that has been denied to them by Democrats and tech critics and Elizabeth Warren and whoever else. You know, famously Peter Thiel and Founders Fund had this line, we wanted flying cars, we got 140 characters. That was an essay that Founders Fund released like 10 or 15 years ago. This impatience, I think, in a way has come to a boil, or has also fueled the reactionary turn where it's like, okay, we try things your way. This is, again, the tech mogul attitude, kind of. That way being perhaps like small d democracy with a weak regulatory system. But now they want to be in charge. And yeah, that certainly applies to their attitudes about drugs, or who's allowed to use them, who's allowed to benefit from them, and who's allowed to profit off of their legalization.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you'd mentioned accelerationism, and I think that's actually a very useful concept. It might be worth like kind of unpacking, because I think that is like, you know, one of the cornerstones of kind of like Silicon Valley ideology, related to both not just drugs, but like a broader political project. So can we like just actually like step back a little bit and just like, you know, like say, what is accelerationism and like, how does it kind of like play out?
The way it's usually treated now, accelerationism, or you might see it on social media, E/ACC, effective accelerationism. That's a term that's really come into prominence through Mark Andreessen and Andreessen Horowitz and kind of companies associated with them. But I think the general idea is that there should just be unfettered technological innovation. And there's an obsession with this notion that of building. That's a term they like a lot, even though, as I've written and argued, like a lot of the tech industry spent the last 10 years building crypto casinos and not much else very substantive or physical, even much less useful. But this idea is just pedal to the metal of technological innovation, but also just doing what they want, unhindered by the regulatory state or really the law. And this is how you get towards a more prosperous and successful society, mostly through AI and the promises of artificial general intelligence, or super intelligence, as some people call it. For a lot of them, that's the ultimate goal, but they consider any attempt to sort of at central planning, at regulation that might inhibit their growth as a real offense, and also as a way of kind of slowing down humanity, because they think that they are speaking on sort of a planetary or even cosmic level, the way Musk does sometimes, which is that this accelerationist attitude is actually what's going to save humanity from all of our existential problems.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. That it is a kind of, it's an attempt to sort of transcend the moment, or to break on through out of history, to like, you know, like move to another, you know, like historical level or epoch. And I should mention, like, I mean, a lot of the rhetoric you're describing, you know, I think listeners might recognize it in a more popular form in what is now called the abundance agenda, right? Like that is a kind of, you know, watered down or popularized aspect of this accelerationist project, right? Like to say that zoning laws are keeping back, you know, like we need to build things, we need to move on. And a lot of it seems to come from a sense of, you know, like that actually the current moment is unsatisfactory, that we're actually in a static moment, but things have not, you know, we have not gotten the flying cars. So yeah, do you want to speak a little bit about that? Like,
I mean, and I think this also derives in some sense from the inequality dividing our society and kind of undergirding all this, which is that, like, from the perspective of tech elites, like, they are very dissatisfied and haven't seen the kind of spectacular sci-fi inspired innovations that they were promised as children. And whereas for, I think, the bulk of us out there and a lot of people in society, you know, they are not really upset about the lack of flying cars. It's more about, of course, day-to-day concerns about money, health insurance here in the U.S., or healthcare, paying bills, the, you know, global climate change, ecological collapse, genocide, all those goodies. But I think that's also what animates the fact that these guys are in such a hurry to get somewhere, whether it's to Mars or to or wherever else, is that they feel that sense of dissatisfaction that maybe a lot of other people don't, and that, but the fact that I don't feel that, or you might not feel that, is not reflective of the fact that our needs are different or that our desires might differ. It actually means that we have a poverty of vision, because they are kind of snobs and condescending. That, like, I don't, you know, they might criticize me for saying, well, like, you just don't get it or understand. To be a little more grounded or practical, one thing I see is a lot of talk about, and I may mispronounce this, but the Kardashev scale. And this is created by a Soviet, this is a concept created by a Soviet writer and scientist, and I think science fiction writer also. And it's supposed to be sort of a rating of the, you know, just like IQ, there's a number attached that they can hold on to. But it's sort of a rating about the success of a civilization based on how much energy it harnesses. And the first step on the scale is harnessing all the energy of the nearby star. So it would be our sun. And this would mean, like, I forget the name of that theorized structure, but that would surround our sun.
Oh yeah. The sphere. Is it the
Dyson sphere?
Dyson sphere.
Yeah. You know, if you had a Dyson sphere surrounding our sun, absorbing all of its energy, using it to create human flourishing and conquer the solar system. That's step one. And Musk tweeted about this the other day, I think actually when he was having his Trump tiff, because this is one of those far-flung sci-fi concepts that really appeals to a lot of these guys. He said something like, you know, climbing the Kardashev scale is what matters. Or he referenced it. And of course, there are like five steps on the scale. And by the top, you're like, harnessing all the energy in the universe or something like that. But it sounds a little ridiculous, of course, but you do hear a little more down here on Earth, a lot of talk from these guys about how, with the desire to build, that energy consumption is kind of a good unto itself and a sign of civilizational health, because especially now, because it's all being poured into data centers and AI. So you just need to build more power plants, whether it's nuclear energy or whatever else, and more data centers. And somehow through this, you get both AGI and eventually you're going to climb this Kardashev scale. And that's why they don't care about global warming anymore. Then they just sort of celebrate energy production and consumption as this, like, civilizational indicator in a way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you did want to push aside, you know, concerns about climate change, I guess you would need some sort of ideology like that, where, like, energy consumption is a unmitigated good, and that there's no side effects that one has to deal with.
And they've all made the leap to the idea that AGI will just fix global warming or climate change somehow. I mean, Eric Schmidt has said this. I mean, he's just sort of an authoritarian Democrat, but also people on the right, and they either, you know, now deny the science a little bit, or just have content themselves with that idea.
Yeah. Or I think there's even the suggestion that we're not on any path to dealing with climate change, and so maybe we need AI and it can solve the problem or whatever.
Yeah, there's a real abandonment by some of them saying, like, oh, we're not going to do it anyway, or, you know, humans are too fractious. I mean, there's an amazing, of course, faith in the machine that somehow all the messiness of humanity and of human politics is going to go away because of the future infinite abundance, and that people who have been incredibly greedy throughout their lives, including tech moguls, will not find anything to fight over, and we'll kind of cede the terrain to all of us.
Yeah, no. I think that's right. And I think, I mean, you mentioned the sort of science fiction element, which I think, you know, in someone like Musk, but many of the others, is a kind of very important aspect. And, you know, like, it goes back partially to the sort of political movements in the early 20th century, like technocracy, which did have this vision that, you know, coming out of the crisis of the First World War and of the Great Depression, thinking that politics has failed, politics is messy, and we need an engineering technological elite to be running things and making society, achieving the utopia that we have the technical means to do so. But it also had a kind of cultural component. In a golden age American science fiction, defined by most famously this editor John W. Campbell, who edited Astounding Science Fiction in the 30s, 40s, until his death in the early 70s. And he was a very important magazine, which was, you know, published the early works of people like Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, and Frank Herbert's Dune was, originally excerpted there, as well as the first, one of their science fiction writers was L. Ron Hubbard, whose first article about Dianetics actually appeared in Astounding Magazine. Now this magazine, can be seen as a variant of this sort of ideology of technocracy, and Campbell very much loved stories about Superman. Figures that kind of, you know, like overcame the problems of the current moment. And, you know, one sees us in, I think in Dianetics itself, it is a kind of, you know, like an attempt to create both a religion and technology that allows human transcendence and, you know, the creation of this enlightened elite. It turns out to be Tom Cruise, who's kind of impressive, I have to say, having watched Mission Impossible. But I mean, like, you know, like Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, you know, with the religion that's kind of created there, and Frank Herbert's Dune, not just that Musk is a fan of, but I believe his former wife Grimes had talked about how their son X. Could become the next Paul Atreides or the real Paul Atreides.
He talks about Dune a lot, and hey, it's a book about space colonization and drugs.
And space colonization, drugs, and genetic engineering, and the creation of a genetic elite to create a Superman who can like transcend space and time and transcend the normal limitations. Now, I have to say, because I'm sure like many of our listeners have read the novels, and this is like a point that must be emphasized, that Dune is, in part, even though it appeared in Astounding, is actually a critique of this ideology. Like, you know, Paul Atreides and his becoming the sort of like Superman is not a good thing in the novel. You can misread the first novel that way, but certainly Frank Herbert wrote sequels to it to indicate that this would be a disastrous path for humanity, that it would only lead to, like, basically, he's very explicit on this point, like a new Hitler, right? Like a new kind of, it does seem like that is the kind of, you know, like imaginative matrix, the sort of political unconscious, is the science fiction vision of both a genetically and drug enhanced Superman who form an elite and who can help humanity rise out of the muck of its current conditions into a new transcendental state, right?
And I think you see Musk pursuing that or kind of enacting some of that in a few different ways, but one of them is having all these kids who apparently he refers to as his legion, which is both, you know, echoes of a Roman legion, but also like this legion of space colonizers potentially, or Ubermensch. And they are also, we should note, almost all boys, and almost all conceived via IVF. So that's intentional. There are 14 confirmed ones, but I think there are probably many more, and there could be dozens or who knows. But And then the other way seems to be back to the drugs, which is in this context more of like almost a transhumanist exercise a way of transcending, you know, the strictures of humanity, or or kind of emphasizing or catalyzing his cognitive enhancement that supposedly exists, rather than, you know, just wanting to get high, which seems to be a lot of what Musk does.
Yeah, no, there's a kind of like sort of performative aspect, you know, which, as we mentioned, has been there as part of this drug culture going back at least to the 50s. Or actually, I mean, arguably, you know, like, and I know this is controversial in many circles to raise this, but I mean, you know, there was also an ideology of sort of reactionary elitism that loved technology and wanted to transcend the current human condition to create an elite of supermen in the early 20th century, most famously in Nazism, which also had, you know, like this element of to create these supermen, the use of drugs, in particular meth, which had been developed in Germany in the 1930s, and which had the advantage of both creating soldiers who didn't need to sleep and could therefore do the blitzkrieg, could be blitzed so that they could, you know, drive tanks for 3 days, and could also have less fear. It would act as an agent of reducing fear. So the Nazi Übermensch was like a variation of this ideology of, you know, like the drug-enhanced world conqueror.
Yeah, when I've sort of half joked, but also think it's a good idea about writing a Silicon Valley history through drugs, I've compared it to that book Blitzed, which is a drug history basically of Nazi Germany and the role that meth and other drugs played, I think, both in Hitler and the Nazi kind of high command, but also among the armies. And you spoke earlier about the CIA and LSD and Cold War era drug research. It does seem to be in World War II, and especially on the Nazi side, is when a lot of that kind of research started to emerge, and when the idea of, like, you know, dosing whole armies probably became more possible and more of a thing people actually did. I don't know. Perhaps there were certain arcane stimulants used in prior centuries.
Yeah, no, but it's certainly on a mass industrial scale. Like that does seem the moment of innovation. I think we've like this is all to sort of indicate the sort of, you know, like the politically dubious side of it. But I want to pick up like more on this sort of like theme of like, you know, why transcendence is necessary, because that does seem to be a big part of the Silicon Valley ideology. And, you know, like I used to think that it was partially a religious substitute, that one sees this, you know, especially in the idea of, you know, transhumanism or singularity, which all seem to have the function of, you know, like providing scientific or rational solutions to what had been metaphysical and religious problems, right? Like, so the problem of like death, you know, like we will, you know, create new science that will allow us to live forever, and therefore, you know, we can. Do you want to talk a little bit about singularity? Because I think that that's kind of related to this effort at acceleration and transcendence.
Well, certainly, over the last couple of decades, one of the unifying or emergent ideas in tech has been somehow they're going to conquer death. I mean, Peter Thiel has spoken about death itself as an ideology, the ideology of death, and he's opposed to it and is kind of angry that people accept it as a default or inevitable part of life. You know, they've graduated beyond, you know, cryogenics or freezing their brains, which, you know, became kind of a laughing stock in the culture, to ideas about merging man and machine or uploading consciousness. And a lot of that was gathered under the idea of the singularity in the last 10 or 15 years, whose foremost practitioner or promoter is Ray Kurzweil, who's now becoming an elderly man, but supposedly takes like 100 pills per day. You know, it'll be interesting when some of these people actually do start dying of natural causes, not to wish ill upon any of them, but like, it's going to happen.
It's going to happen. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. We have not yet conquered death. I mean, it is not death. Death is not, unfortunately, just an ideology.
Right. And, you know, and this was an idea that's been sort of in wide circulation in tech. But I think you could argue that AI and AGI have kind of given it, in a way, actually a new life, and have got kind of given it a more coherent form or end goal. Because before, when they're just sort of talking about like, oh, we're going to all upload our minds, or, you know, we're going to our brains are going to be in the cloud, there wasn't really a sense of what does that mean. We still don't necessarily know what that means, but with AGI, or what that might look like. But supposedly, you know, that this is the new sort of singularity or way of transcending the human condition and mortality, is that somehow we're going to invent God in a computer, and then we get to join it.
Yeah. No, I mean, that does seem to be the pitch. And, you know, like, and this is not to like undersell the, you know, the genuine achievements of AI, which as a technology does seem to have, you know, be able to do new things, or and have useful properties. But like a lot of this, these claims, like, they're not really borne out by anything that AI has achieved. I mean, like, AI is still just a computational thing. It doesn't have consciousness, like, in any, like real sense. And we don't, consciousness itself is an unsolved problem. It's an unsolved philosophical and scientific problem. We don't know what consciousness is. So, like, how we can achieve consciousness in a machine that itself does computational activities and has no self-awareness, I'm not sure about. And whether that can actually lead to the creation of God it seems like they're making a lot of leaps, or a lot of, like, you know, like, is this just like Silicon Valley hype, or like do they actually like believe that, you know, what they're selling? Are they high on their own supply?
I think a lot of them do believe it now, in that, like, AGI has become a bit of a religion in Silicon Valley. It's often spoken of in religious or eschatological terms. You know, there are also groups that have cult-like qualities that, you know, that split off from effective altruism or elsewhere, that are made up of, like, people who work in this industry. And there's a way in which this promise of AGI and immortality is a very welcome substitute for religion for people who might otherwise either be unsettled in that regard, or be atheists or something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's a religion for the scientific, or of a scientific age. I mean, just Scientology was also an early religion for a scientific age.
And it becomes this sort of self-sustaining or self-justifying thing where, well, we're not there yet, but just keep pouring the resources into it and give us more, more, more. You know, that's why Sam Altman needs trillions of dollars to make the new NVIDIA competitor and all these other sorts of things. Is that if there's some unlimited payoff at the end, then there's no amount of resources now that could be considered, you know, too much to spend. And that is, I think, the operating logic for a lot of these people. Excuse me. It might be cynical for some of them. I mean, this is something I encounter in crypto a lot, is people ask me, like, do people really believe this, that this is like a financial revolution or whatever else? Or are they just kind of, you know, profiting off of some suckers? And I do think there's a mix of both. But in AI, there's so much money being brought to play now that I also think it's easy to become or a true believer, to think you're among the converted.
Yeah. No. I mean, as often is the case, like, you know, what's in people's economic or financial interest is also something that it's very easy for them to believe. And I would sort of add that, I mean, the social status that they enjoy confirms them in their sense of being part of this esoteric elite that is at the cutting edge of humanity. If, like, all the sort of politicians and all the venture capitalist funders think that, you know, these guys are like the top people and should be deferred to, then it's easy to understand why they also think that, right? Like, they receive no skepticism or anything that would lead them to doubt it. Or if they do, you know, they're very hostile to journalism. So if they do encounter, you know, like any sort of criticism, they become very, like, anxious and angry and try to suppress it.
Yeah. And, you know, you see things from, frankly, some of the more credulous industry journalists, like Kevin Roos was published an article in the New York Times recently saying, like, you know, there's just a lot of people in San Francisco who really think AGI is soon, you know, and and like everyone I seem to meet is saying this. And you hear that kind of talk. Well, that's because you live in that bubble and everything. There are all these incentives towards believing that and people saying that, as you just described. But once you get outside of that, you don't, you know, life is much different for most of us. Not to say that, you know, I'm Mr. Average or normie, but, you know, once you get outside of San Francisco, the belief just isn't there. And I think the payoff isn't there yet, but.
Yeah. No. I mean, in terms of like sort of payoff or, you know, desire for, you know, transcendence, I mean, it might be good to ground this, not just in the sort of, you know, substitute religion, but like the larger crisis of capitalism, which has, you know, gone on since the early 70s when the sort of post-war golden age ended. And there's been a kind of, you know, like a longer period of slower growth and stagnation in the sense that we aren't building things. I mean, I think that's, you know, rooted in a genuine material reality. And in some ways, Silicon Valley was the exception or attempted to be the exception, but they have not actually, you know, like lived up to the hopes that people had for them. And it seems like the dream that they have to sell to keep all this going, to keep the money flowing, and to keep themselves going becomes larger and larger, even as the returns become smaller and smaller.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, one of their own frustrations, perhaps, or even perhaps a source of insecurity, I would argue, is that like there wasn't a lot created out of Silicon Valley, I would argue, enduring over the last 15 years. Or at least on the more positive side of the ledger, like there are things that we may take for granted or that we can all appreciate, like, you know, instant messaging and email and kind of instantaneous communication in general. But there's not a lot, especially from the zero interest rate years, I would argue, when money was really cheap to borrow. They made a lot of big bets, but not necessarily a lot came out of it. I mean, a lot of the big tech companies, monopolies, were actually founded, you know, during Bush or Obama administrations. So that in a way, I think, has spurred the tech industry to try to make even bigger bets and take an even bigger leap into this sort of potentially infinite pool of prosperity called AI.
Yeah. No. I mean, we'll see where it goes, but it does seem like, you know, to return to the original topic, like this kind of both explains, you know, why the drug use might be common and also some of the impact of the drug use itself. Like if you want to have, you know, a great sense of optimism and like, you know, like you're the Superman and, you know, like the pie in the sky is just around the corner, you know, we're going to hit Big Rock Candy Mountain, it probably helps to be a little high.
Certainly. And you know, one of the noted side effects of chronic ketamine use can be feelings of grandiosity and combined with a whole other host of bad side effects. But
yeah, we're not doctors here, but I mean, like that does seem to be, there's a little bit of that that can be detected.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So on that note, I want to thank Jacob Silverman. Look out for his book, Gilded Rage, and look for the books he's already published, which are all very enlightening on the world of finance and Silicon Valley and capitalism. Thank you, Jacob.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Plan on flying? In order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID. Learn how to get your real ID today at tsa.gov/real ID or visit your local DMV.